Hi, this is Pastor Matt, and I want to welcome you to our Blue Oaks Church podcast. At the end of this episode, feel free to download our Blue Oaks Church app, where you'll be able to access resources, events, and ways to get connected at Blue Oaks and in the community. The app is the easiest way to share this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around Blue Oaks. Most importantly, though, I just hope that you enjoy this episode and it inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey.
Well, good morning and happy Easter. If we haven't met, my name is Matt. I'm the teaching pastor here at Blue Oaks, and I'm really glad you decided to spend part of your day with us. What we're doing today isn't just happening here. It's happening all over the world across different cultures and languages and time zones. Millions of people are gathering in spaces just like this, centered around one single claim. It's not just an idea. It's not just a tradition. It's not just something that we revisit once a year and think, you know, I should probably look more into that at some point. It's a claim that 3 days after Jesus was crucified, the stone was rolled away, the tomb was empty, he was not there, he rose from the dead. And whether you've been around church for a long time or you're just exploring what you believe, that claim sits at the center of everything we're doing today. Because if it's not true, then at best, we're remembering a meaningful story from the past. And honestly, there are plenty of meaningful stories we could gather around that don't require this kind of commitment on Sunday morning. But if it's true, then we're dealing with something that doesn't just belong in history. It actually reaches into the present. Last week in this series, we stood at the cross and we talked about how the kind of king that Jesus turned out to be, not one who used power the way the world uses power, but one who moved towards suffering rather than away from it. One who loved without turning away. And today we come to the empty tomb, which when you really think about it, is where the whole thing either comes together or it quietly falls apart. And there isn't really any middle category for it. Because if Jesus died and stayed dead, then you can admire him, you can quote him, you can even be moved by him. But at the end of the day, he just becomes one more inspiring figure from history who, you know, did some powerful things, but then he lost. But if the tomb is empty, if Jesus really rose from the dead, then we're not just dealing with a teacher or a martyr or even a religious founder. We're dealing with someone who altered reality itself. That's why the resurrection has always been the hinge point of the Christian faith. If it didn't happen, well, Christianity collapses under its own claims. But if it did happen, then it has implications for everything, for hope, for suffering, for forgiveness, for death, for the future, for what it means for us to trust God with our own lives. And one of the things I appreciate about the resurrection accounts in the Gospels is that they don't read like people expected this to happen. The first witnesses don't show up confident and triumphant saying, well, of course, this is resurrection morning. They come carrying spices. They come expecting death. They come sad. They come confused and trying to do the next faithful thing in front of them, which means Easter begins not with certainty, but with grief. It begins with people who are not unlike us, people living inside their own assumptions about how this world works, people who know what death does, people who know what disappointment feels like, people who have seen hope collapse before them. And then they arrive at the tomb, and everything changes. And so today I want to sit with this story and I want to look carefully at what happened at the tomb and what it meant for the first witnesses and what it means for you and me. Because Easter is not just this claim that something amazing happened once. It's a claim that Jesus is alive now and that at Christianity at its core is about a relationship with the living God. So let's step into this moment. If you have a Bible, you can turn to Luke chapter 24. We're going to begin reading at verse 1. And I just want to read this slowly because the details matter sometimes more than we realize. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed their faces to the ground. So what I want you to notice first is not what they found, but what they brought with them. So they brought spices, which tells us everything about what they were expecting. They were not going to celebrate. They were not going with anticipation. They were going with some, they weren't going with some kind of confidence that this is what Jesus predicted, and so now it's happening. They were going to finish a burial. In that culture, burials didn't always happen all at once. A body would be wrapped and then placed in a tomb, and then the family would, or close followers would return and complete the process. They would anoint the body with spices as a final act of care or honor. And so what these women are doing is part of the grieving process. They're showing us what love does in the face of loss. They're caring for someone they believe is gone. And that matters because it reminds us that the first people at the tomb were not these people of extraordinary faith in that moment. They were grieving and they were disoriented and they were doing the next faithful thing they knew how to do. They're not theologizing the moment. They're not debating resurrection. They're not forming a small group to process what Jesus meant when he said, I am the resurrection and the life. They're not, you know, no one shows up at a tomb like thinking like, well, let's just see how this goes. They're just carrying spices. And then they arrive and something is immediately wrong. The stone is rolled away, which, by the way, is not what they were concerned about on the way. Mark tells us they were actually asking each other, who's going to move the stone for us? This big, giant stone, like who's going to roll it away? Which is another interesting detail. They're trying to solve a practical problem while they're carrying a grief that they don't yet know how to process. It's interesting how often we focus on manageable problems when we're actually facing something that's so much deeper. But when they arrived, the problem they were worried about is no longer a problem because the stone is already moved. And when they step inside, the body is gone. And at that point, they're not thinking, well, this must be the resurrection. They're thinking something is wrong. Luke says they were wondering about this. You know, that word actually carries a sense of confusion or disorientation or trying to make sense of something that they didn't really have a category for. This is not clarity. This is not confidence. This is the beginning of disruption. And then suddenly these two figures appear, clothes gleaming, unmistakably not ordinary, and the women are overwhelmed and they bow down and they're afraid because whatever is happening here is not what they came for. So this situation is not becoming more and more clear for these women. It's becoming more and more confusing. When what they encounter at the tomb doesn't immediately resolve anything for them. In fact, it creates a new problem because now the categories that they were relying on in their life don't really work anymore. Like they understood death. They knew what happened on Friday. They watched Jesus suffer. They watched him die. They watched his body be taken down and placed in a tomb. That was tragic, but it was not unfamiliar. It fit with their understanding of the way the world works. People die, even good people die, even people you believe in, even people you hope might change everything. What they were not prepared for was a missing body, an empty tomb, a reality that didn't line up with anything that they had ever experienced before. And this is so important because one of the things that the resurrection does, I think both then and now, is it confronts the assumptions that we build our lives on. Most of us move through life with a settled sense of how things generally work. We may not say it out loud, but we kind of just carry these quiet expectations about what leads to a good life. what gives us a sense of security, like what we can ultimately rely on. We assume that if we make good decisions, things will generally go well. We assume that if we work really hard, we can create a life that feels stable. We assume that if we can maintain a certain level of control, we can keep things from falling apart. And underneath all of this is an even deeper assumption that death is final, that loss is permanent, and that what is gone is gone. And for the most part, those assumptions hold until they don't. Because at some point, everyone runs into moments where life doesn't cooperate with our expectations. A relationship breaks down that you thought would last. A plan that felt solid begins to unravel. Something that you were counting on disappears, and you're left trying to make sense of a reality that doesn't fit the framework that you were used to understanding it from. And that's where these women are standing. They've come to this tomb with this set of assumptions about what is true and what is possible and what happens next. And the empty tomb begins to dismantle those assumptions. But here's what's so interesting. The resurrection doesn't immediately replace those assumptions with clarity. It doesn't instantly give them this like new, fully formed understanding of what God is doing. It begins with disorientation. It begins with the unsettled realization that what they thought was final might not actually be final after all. And that can feel uncomfortable because we tend to prefer explanations that stabilize us. We want things to make sense quickly. We want resolution. We want something we can hold on to that will restore our sense of control. Like, you know, we're not opposed to mystery. We just prefer it to resolve itself within a reasonable time frame. But the resurrection doesn't do that for us. It loosens our grip on the assumptions that we thought we could trust. It introduces the possibility that reality is larger than we thought, that God is not confined to the patterns that we've observed, that what looks like an ending might not actually be an ending. And if that's true, then it doesn't just change how we read this story, it changes how we read everything, changes how we read our own lives. Because now the question becomes, where have we quietly accepted something as final that God may not be finished with? Where have we drawn conclusions about what's possible and what's repairable and what's redeemable that might not actually be the last word? The women don't have answers yet, but they're standing in a moment that's about to redefine everything they thought they knew. If we go back to the text, the moment that reframes everything doesn't come from the women, it actually comes from the question they're asked. Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is risen. He's not here. What's striking is that they're not immediately given an explanation. They're given a question. And it's not just any question, a question that exposes the assumption that they walked in with. Because from their perspective, what they were doing just made a ton of sense. Like, of course you go to a tomb to find someone who is dead. That's not confusing. That's rational. That's the way the world works. Which is what makes this question so disruptive. Why are you looking for the living in a place defined by death? The question is doing more than correcting a misunderstanding about one moment. It's introducing an entirely different way of seeing reality. You know, in the ancient world, the boundary between life and death was absolute. Like, there was no category for someone stepping out of death and returning in a transformed, embodied way. There was no category for this, not philosophically, not medically, not religiously. This isn't a familiar idea showing up in a new story. This is a new kind of claim altogether. Even within Jewish thought, there was this hope for a future resurrection at the end of time, but no one was expecting this to happen in the middle of the story to one person ahead of everyone else, which means this is not just surprising. Like, this is category breaking. It's not just we misplaced the body. It's something has happened that requires a new understanding of what's possible. And one of the reasons this account carries so much weight historically is that it doesn't read like a story shaped to convince skeptics. If you were trying to invent a persuasive narrative in the first century, you wouldn't center the testimony around women. Like, because their witness at the time wasn't even considered legally reliable in many settings. And yet this is what the Gospels actually do. And it's not because they're coming up with some stronger argument in that culture. It's because this is actually what happened. But the real weight of this moment is not just historical, it's personal, because that question doesn't stay in the first century. It has a way of traveling. Why do you look for the living among the dead? It's a question about location, but it's also a question about expectation. It's asking, where are you going to find life? In a place like the Bay Area, where we can be very thoughtful and driven and capable, it's not that we don't look for life, it's that we tend to look for it in places that ultimately cannot sustain it. We look for it in achievement, in building something meaningful, in creating a life that feels stable and successful and secure. We look for it in relationships, in being known and being valued and being chosen. We look for it in experiences, in staying engaged and stimulated and moving forward. We even look for it in things that promise just enough transformation to feel hopeful, like another book or another system or another way to optimize your life so that this version finally works. And none of those things are wrong in themselves. They matter. They have value. But what this question begins to expose is that when we ask those things to carry more than they're designed to carry, they eventually collapse under that weight. Because anything that is ultimately subject to decay or loss or change cannot bear the full weight of your hope. And so the resurrection is not just telling us that Jesus is alive. It's telling us that life, that real life, that lasting life is found in a place we wouldn't have thought to look. And so the question becomes less abstract. Where are you looking for life right now? What are you depending on to give you a sense that things are okay, that you're okay? And is it something that can actually hold that weight? Because if the cross showed us a kind of love that doesn't turn away, the resurrection shows us a kind of life that cannot be taken away. And if the invitation of Easter is not just to believe that something happened, it's to reconsider where you've been looking for life. So as we sit with this moment, is the empty tomb, the question, the confusion that is beginning to give way to clarity, there's a larger implication that starts to come into view, because the resurrection is not just an isolated event. It's not just something remarkable that happened once. It functions as a kind of confirmation or a validation or a vindication of everything that Jesus was saying and doing all along. Throughout his life, Jesus made claims that, if you're honest, they're difficult to categorize. He wasn't just teaching moral principles. He wasn't just like offering great spiritual insights. Like, he spoke about himself in a way that put himself in the center of history. He forgave sins, something that in Jewish thought was understood to be something only God could do. He redefined identity, not around performance, but around the relationship with him. He spoke about God not just as like this distant authority, but as a father. And he invited people into that same relationship. And perhaps most strikingly, he repeatedly told his followers that he would suffer and that he would be killed and that he would raise again. Now, it's one thing to make those kinds of claims. History is not short on people who have made bold spiritual assertions. It's another thing entirely for those claims to be validated in a way that cannot be easily dismissed. And this is where the resurrection matters so much, because if Jesus stays in a tomb, then his words become interesting, maybe even inspiring, but ultimately uncertain. But if the tomb is empty, man, then his words take on a different kind of weight. In a sense, the resurrection becomes the lens through which we see everything. It's the moment that forces you to go back and reconsider everything that came before it. It's the difference between reading someone's ideas as thoughtful and meaningful and then realizing, man, you may have misunderstood who it is that you're talking to. Because if Jesus has authority over death itself, then that changes how we understand everything that he said about life. If he can step out of a tomb, then his claims about forgiveness and grace, about the kingdom of God, about what ultimately matters, those are no longer just philosophical ideas. They become the most significant truths in history. And I think for many people today, the hesitation to follow Jesus isn't always emotional. It's often intellectual. We live in a world shaped by scientific thinking, by observable patterns, by what can be measured and tested. And in that kind of an environment, something like the resurrection can feel like difficult to place. Like not necessarily impossible, but definitely outside of the category that we're used to working within. But what's worth considering is that the earliest followers of Jesus, they were not predisposed to believe this either. They weren't waiting at the tomb going, wow, this is exactly what we were expecting. They were confused. They were skeptical. And in some cases, they were resistant. Thomas, one of the disciples, famously said he wouldn't believe unless he could see and touch the wounds himself, which, if we're honest, feels like a pretty reasonable standard. And yet something happened, not just to the tomb, but to them. These same individuals who were hiding, who were uncertain, who were afraid, they became the people who were willing to publicly stake their lives on the claim that Jesus was alive. Not because it was convenient, not because it advanced their status, but because they were convinced that it was true. And at the center of their message was not simply Jesus taught something helpful. It was Jesus is alive. Which brings the question a little closer to home. Because at some point, the resurrection moves from being a historical claim to being a personal one. If Jesus is alive, then he's not just a figure to be studied. He is a person to be responded to. And that doesn't mean having every answer to every question you have. It doesn't mean resolving every tension, but it does mean taking seriously the possibility that what happened at the tomb is not just something to be observed from a distance, but something that has implications for how we understand God, how we understand ourselves, and the direction of our lives. Because if the question was, why do you look for the living among the dead? The way of Jesus begins to answer it. Life is not found in what cannot last. It's found in the one who has overcome death itself. And if that's true, then Jesus was not just right about what he said. I mean, he's revealing what is ultimately real and what is ultimately true. All right, now as all of this begins to come into focus, the empty tomb, the question, the implications of what it means that Jesus is alive, it eventually leads to something that is both simple and very personal for you and me. One of the places where I think there's often confusion, especially in a culture like ours, is around what Christianity actually is. And for some people, it's primarily a set of beliefs. For others, it's a moral framework. It's a way of trying to live a good life. For others, it's a tradition, something that's familiar, something they grew up around, something maybe they return to occasionally. But at its core, Christianity is not primarily about rules or rituals or even ideas. It's about a relationship. It's about the possibility of knowing and being known by the living God. And that's only possible because of the resurrection. Because if Jesus were still in the tomb, then everything we've talked about is in the past. It's something meaningful, maybe even inspiring, but ultimately it's distant. But if he's alive, it's not about looking back. It's about being invited in. Invited into a relationship that's not based on performance. It's not based on getting everything right. It's not based on having your life fully together, but based on what he's already done. Which means the same pattern that we've been seeing throughout this series continues here. So at the beginning, at the triumphal entry, we see a king that didn't arrive the way everyone expected, not with force or spectacle, but with kind of humility that was easy to misunderstand. And then at the cross, we saw what that kind of kingship actually looks like when it's fully revealed, a love that doesn't turn away, even in the face of suffering. And now at the empty tomb, we see something else entirely, not just a love on display, but a power that's redefined and a life that can't be taken away. And when you put them all three together, the kind of king he is, the kind of love he shows, the kind of life he carries, you begin to realize this is not just something to observe. It's an invitation. It's an invitation to trust. It's an invitation to turn toward God, maybe for the first time, or maybe in a way that is more honest than it's been for you in a really long time. It's an invitation to stop carrying things on your own that you were never meant to carry. And I know that for many people, especially in a room like this, that step is not always easy. It can feel uncertain. There are questions, there are doubts, there are things that don't get fully resolved. Most of us would prefer a version of faith where everything is explained in advance, and then we get to decide whether or not we want to participate. But the resurrection doesn't work that way. It invites us to respond before everything is fully resolved. And that response is not complicated. It's not about saying the right words. It's not about reaching some level of certainty. It's simply about trust. Trusting that what Jesus did on the cross was enough. Trusting that his life now makes a relationship with God possible. Trusting that what he offers is actually better than what we've been trying to build on our own. And for some of you, that may be a first step, a moment where you realize, maybe for the first time, this is not just a story. This is an invitation for you. For others of you, it may be a return, a recognition that somewhere along the way, your attention drifted, your trust shifted, and today is a moment to come back. Because the empty tomb is not just proof that Jesus was right, it's an open door. And sometimes it takes a moment, like a glimpse like this or a disruption, to realize that what we thought was finished might not be finished. I came across a story recently that I hadn't been able to shake. It comes out of World War II. This is before like the internet. This is before modern technology. There was a father whose son had been gone missing in the war. So no confirmation of him, no body, just gone. And for years, the family lived in this space where it's just very difficult to live in, not knowing whether to grieve, not knowing whether to hope. And at one point, this father was walking through a museum that had photographs from the war, just rows and rows of images of soldiers and prisoners. And as he's walking through, something made him stop. There was a photograph, and in the background, barely noticeable, was a man. And he wasn't centered, he wasn't highlighted. It was just like this man that drew his attention in the background. And as he leaned in closer, he thought, that's my son. But it couldn't be, because as far as he knew, the story was already over. And yet the more he looked, the more convinced he became, that's him, that's my son, he's alive. And what changed in that moment wasn't just what he saw, it's what he thought was final. Because something he had already grieved, something he had already accepted was finished, suddenly wasn't finished anymore. And in a very real way, that's what the resurrection does. It confronts the places where we've quietly concluded that's over. that part of my life is done. That can't be restored. And it introduces a possibility we wouldn't have allowed ourselves to believe. What if it's not over? What if what you thought was final isn't final? And then the question is simply, what will you do with it? Because at some point, this moves from being a story you understand to a decision you make. And I want to be real clear about what that decision is and what it isn't. This is not about becoming more religious. It's not about trying harder to get your life together first. It's not about any of that. It's about responding to a person. It's about responding to Jesus, who stepped into our world and carried our sin and walked through death and then walked out of it. And now he offers you a personal relationship with God that is not based on your performance, but on what he's already done. And for some of you, if you're honest, you've been circling this for a while. You've had questions, you've been thinking, you've been exploring, but you've never actually taken a step. Not because you're opposed, but because you're just waiting for everything to feel like it's settled first. And the reality is, everything will not completely be settled. But there can still be a moment where you say, you know, I don't have everything figured out, but I'm ready to trust. And so I'd like to create a moment for that. And if you're here today and you want to say, you know what, I don't have a relationship with God, but I want one, or I've drifted and I want to come back, then I'm going to invite you to respond. I'm going to lead you in a prayer, a simple prayer. It's nothing magical about the words I'm going to say, but because sometimes language helps us move into what we're already sensing, I'm just going to ask you to pray this quietly in your hearts. You don't have to say it out loud. But if this reflects what you would like to say to God, then just make these words your words. Would you just bow your heads with me? God, I don't have everything figured out, but I believe I am here on purpose, not by accident, and I believe you're real. I know that I've tried to build my life on my own terms, and I've made decisions that I regret, and I carry things that maybe I was never meant to carry. And so today, I'm choosing to trust you. I believe that Jesus died for me. I believe that he carried my sin and my failure and my brokenness. And I believe that he rose again. And so today, I'm turning toward you. I'm asking you to forgive me. I'm asking you to make me new. I'm asking you to lead my life from this point forward. I don't know what that's going to look like, but I'm just saying that I trust you. And I thank you for not giving up on me, and I thank you for loving me. And I pray this in Jesus' name, amen. And I want to say that if you've prayed that, even with uncertainty, it's a real important moment. Not because of the words, but because of what they represent. The beginning of a relationship with the living God. Because Easter is not just a celebration of something that happened. It's the beginning of something that God wants to do in you and me today. All right, would you stand with me and let's join the worship team as they lead us in a closing song.
Hey, once again, thanks for listening. We hope you found something in this week's message to take away and apply to your life this week. If you live in the Bay Area, we would love to have you join us for one of our weekend services. For directions or information about what we have for you or your family, your students, you can go to blueoaks.church or download the app today. And we hope to see you on Sunday soon.